Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kbu.org.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire, and my name is Pierre Fograng, and I've got an announcement to make first. Tonight, there will be a panel discussion on Standing Rock and Us, the lessons learned. And one of the panelists will be KBOO's Jacqueline Keeler and other people from the 350 PDX organization. And The goal of the discussion is to explore solidarity with the Standing Rock protests and protect fossil that and fighting the fossil fuel projects that are being inflicted on the public elsewhere in the country. And we're going to talk about resistance in the Pacific Northwest. So that is tonight, 7 p.m. And it will be at Patagonia, 907 Northwest Irving. So 7 o'clock tonight at Patagonia, 907 Northwest Irving, a panel discussion on Standing Rock and all of us. And so now on to our guest. Our guest is Daniel Lazar, who is a author. One of his recent books is The Frozen Republic, How the Constitution is Paralyzing Democracy. He also writes for Consortium News and I believe The Nation magazine. So, Daniel Lazar, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Well, very interesting article. I read it in Consortium on the title of it is America's Putin Derangement Syndrome. So let's talk about that.
Well, I mean, Putin is driving America crazy.
He is.
He's driving the Democrats crazy, certainly. But what Americans don't, or what, let me correct that, what Democrats don't want to admit is that they really have, are responsible for Putin being in the position he is today, where he can call the shots in the Middle East. I mean, American policy has been just perplexing. It's been completely counterproductive, disastrous. It is essentially responsible for the mess that exists in that part of the world today. It's collapsed so completely that there's only one man left to sort of clean the mess up, and that seems to be Vladimir Putin.
Well, you start out the article by talking about the New York Times calling Putin the big winner in our elections. That he's working to, this is the New York Times speaking, he's working to delegitimize American democracy and to weaken NATO. And as you point out, the U.S. and NATO are doing pretty good at screwing themselves up.
Yes, that certainly is true. I mean, I don't want to let Putin off the hook. I mean, mm-hmm. this guy is he's a rightist, he's a traditionalist, he's a gay basher. He's a lot of bad things. I mean, he's so bad that Steve Bannon praises him. So that's going to give an idea of what Putin's politics
take
are really
Putin,
like.
Maybe he's going to take Putin lessons.
But he's not the devil. He's not Satan, and he has some real national interests to pursue in the Middle East, and as the U.S. does as well. But his at the moment seem to be much more coherent mm-hmm. than America's are. All I'm saying.
Well, you know, the other day I was at our Senator Jeff Merkley had a town hall meeting at a high school here, and oh my golly, it was in the school cafeteria. They cleared out all the tables. Big, huge room, totally packed. I think there's 2,000 people in the cafeteria and about another 1,000 people outside on the lawn peering in the big windows and everything. And Jeff Merkley, I mean, he was the only Democratic leader to endorse Bernie Sanders. And he talked and gave a good talk about how we deal with President Donald Trump and everything, but I have to say he went on the same thing. It's really kind of tired, this idea that somehow Putin orchestrated this thing and that Trump is Putin's puppet and whatever.
It's just insane. We have two right-wing parties.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard to know, you know, which one is worse. The Democrats are pursuing this dangerous warmongering, you know, policy towards Russia, and it's going to get them nowhere. It is a disaster, and it's just remarkable that they're doing it. It's a real head scratcher. I mean, Putin did no one. There's no compelling evidence that Putin hacked the DNC. That's number one. Number two, if Putin is now calling his shots in the Middle East, it's because the U.S. policy has collapsed so completely that there's no one else left to do it. That's mm-hmm. simply the way it is.
Well, you know, I think my take on this is that I would guess that the Russians have been hacking the DNC and a whole lot of other venues in the United States. We have been doing it to them, and they do it to us. And hacking is sort of what all these big countries do. The big thing is I see no evidence that Putin leaked anything. In fact, it would seem to me that if you have any juicy information, it's smarter to hold on to it and kind of use it in private, you know. But the big excuse is that Putin is blackmailing Trump, and there's no evidence for that. In fact, one of the leakers, Craig Murray, this former British ambassador, he says that he was the one who got the information, not from a Russian. He got it from some Washington insider, and he passed it on, I think, to WikiLeaks. So if there's going to be an investigation, they should certainly call Craig Murray and ask him to tell us more about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to prove or disprove whether Putin hacked the DNC. All we can say is that the DNI report, the Director of National Intelligence report, was most unimpressive. They presented little or no evidence as to the hacking. And Craig Murray's report, that it was actually an inside job, a disgruntled DNC staffer who liked Bernie Sanders and, you know, therefore was pissed off at the way that Clinton had sabotaged his campaign. I mean, that still strikes me as the most plausible explanation for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that U.S. policy in the Middle East has just been incoherent. I mean, essentially what Hillary has said all along is that the U.S. must topple Bashar al-Assad because somehow Bashar al-Assad's presence is aiding al-Qaeda and ISIS. Now, this just mm-hmm. makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's America and its allies who are actually funneling aid to Al-Qaeda and even ISIS, as Hillary herself admitted in a 2014 email, and made public by WikiLeaks, by the way. And number two, Bashar al-Assad's forces are the main forces battling ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So how would removing Assad hurt ISIS and Al-Qaeda? Quite the contrary. It would just pave the way for them to march into Damascus and take over the presidential palace. And that would be a disaster of the first order. Can you imagine if Al-Qaeda or ISIS controlled Syria, a country, on the border of Turkey and only a few hundred miles from Greece, for example?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the neighboring countries would be directly and seriously threatened. Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, which contains roughly one-fifth of the world's fossil fuel reserves. I mean, this policy was insane. And the U.S. And their allies were sticking to it with dissent in the U.S. only from Bernie Sanders and a little bit from Donald Trump, believe it or not. And abroad, the only one opposing it was Vladimir Putin. So now that policy's collapsed, and Putin's on top. This is what happens in international affairs when you bet wrong. You wind up paying a price. And for the U.S., that price is the preeminence of Russia in terms of sorting out the mess in the Levant.
Do you think that the Europeans realize this and just don't say so? Or what's, they're the ones who are getting bearing the brunt of all these refugees.
They were afraid to part ways with the U.S., and they are also part of NATO, which has been pursuing a highly provocative and confrontational policy with Russia and Eastern Europe. So they were on board and were afraid to get off. So now they're in a pickle as well. I mean, it was a really bad strategy, a really bad calculation, and miscalculation, actually. And when you screw up in that way, you pay the price. That's just the way the world works.
Well, I think Putin, was said that the main reason that he was entering this conflict is he wants to keep the jihadis away from Russia. He's already been dealing with what he calls terrorists in the Southern Caucasus, and he doesn't want any more. In fact, I think most of there's a lot of Chechens who are fighting with ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And this
not
is
only Chechens, but, not only Chechens, but Kazakhs and Uzbekis. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's estimated that perhaps 10,000 fighters from the former Soviet territories are now part of the now have joined the Syrian rebels, and if those people are victorious, then they'll go home and they will be all the more dangerous as a consequence. So Putin doesn't want that, and that's why he figures it's better to stop them in Syria than to try to stop them in Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan or, mm-hmm. or France or America. So that policy strikes me as a good deal more sensible than Clinton, and it's why Putin seems to be prevailing at the moment.
Well, do you think the U.S. does want that outcome?
did they? That's a really tough question. That's a very good question. Was it incompetence or was it just viciousness? I'm really myself. I've puzzled over that. I'm still not quite sure of the answer. I mean, I think it's a question of psychology to a degree, and I think that Obama was a weak leader who was torn. But I think that the real problem, the ultimate problem, is the U.S. Saudi alliance, because Saudi is a main sponsor of these terrorist groups, and that.
We got a signal.
And the U.S. is not going to part ways with Saudi Arabia very willingly.
Yeah, we kind of lost your voice there for about a half a minute.
I'm sorry about that.
Okay. Well, you know, for evidence of this thing, we have, well, we got Zbigniew Brzezinski writing about the grand chessboard, and then, of course, his bright idea of sending Mujahideen into Afghanistan when they were allied with the Soviets. You know, we thought that was a bright idea, and apparently Jimmy Carter signed off on it. And so, you know, there seems to be this strategy, and now, at least according to some people, there's this growing kind of Eurasian alliance between Russia and China and all the various Turkic nations there in Central Asia, and they may well be the dominant power of the future, and maybe the U.S. is trying to prevent that at all costs.
Yes, yeah, some kind of grand struggle seems to be underway. You know, in the grand chessboard, Brzezinski called for breaking Russia up into three parts. So Russia really had cause to be alarmed, and now the NATO is conducting these very provocative exercises on its borders. This is a very dangerous game the U.S. and NATO are playing. And Russia has every right to be concerned. It just seems really foolish in the extreme.
Well, you know, it seems to me the U.S. has been, well, if you want to go back in history, the West has been kind of obsessed about Russia when they were ruled by the Czars, and then when they were ruled by the Soviets, and now when they're ruled by the Putin and his allies. It's like the when you think of the history of our dealings with Russia, especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union, this is probably the main reason why Putin is very popular in Russia, because he stopped the Yeltsin crowd from giving away the store. I mean,
he also stopped Russia's economic collapse as well.
Mm-hmm.
Putin is, for the Russians, he's like kind of a super FDR. I mean, Russia saw a collapse under Yeltsin, which is really just almost without equal in a modern industrial country. And Putin stopped that. So therefore, his authority seems to be beyond challenge in Russia itself. And the U.S. and NATO have certainly pursued the most provocative course since 1989 to 91, pushing up NATO right to Russia's borders. In Brzezinski's case, calling for its splitting up Russia into three parts. A real campaign aimed at reducing Russia to a third-rate power, and Putin has fought that.
Well, he's really succeeded, and in your article in Consortium News, it's very interesting. You talk about the U.S. had this policy of talking about democracy and working with these Gulf autocratic rulers and the Salafists. And then when Joe Biden complained about it, and then he was forced to apologize to them. Tell us a little bit about that. That seems very strange to me.
Yeah, well, you know, Joe Biden is a guy who talks very freely. In October 2014, he appeared at Harvard's Kennedy School, and someone asked him a question, and he opened up, was quite forthright. And among the things he said that America's problems were its allies. And he said that America's Gulf allies, quote, were so determined to take Assad down and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war that they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens of thousands of tons of military equipment into anyone who would fight against Assad, except the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from the other parts of the world, quote, unquote. I mean, the tape is on YouTube, so you can check it out. That was a pretty stunning admission that Saudi Arabia was funding al-Qaeda. Now, Obama could have said, whoops, you know, and we got to fix our policy because this is clearly intolerable. He could have said that, but he said the opposite. Instead, he literally made Joe Biden phone up various Persian Gulf capitals and apologize for telling the truth. Pretty amazing.
It is. It is.
It's astonishing. You know, and then just this past September, John Kerry was caught on tape at a private, you know, speaking privately with Syrian exiles at the UN, in which he said, the reason Russia came into Syria is because ISIL was getting stronger. Daesh was threatening the possibility of going to Damascus and so forth. And that's why Russia came in, because they didn't want a Daesh government and they supported Assad. And we know this was growing. We were watching. We saw that Daesh was growing in strength and we thought Assad was threatened. We thought, however, this is the important part, we thought, however, that we could probably manage and that Assad might then negotiate. Instead of negotiating, he got Putin in to support him. So it's truly complicated. In other words, the U.S. was hoping to use ISIS as a lever to push Assad to the negotiating table. Rather than combating ISIS, it was trying to use ISIS. This is devastating.
It is. It's just amazing to me that, you know, ISIS, you know, a bunch of really demented head shoppers, and the U.S. thinks that somehow we can use them to our advantage. I think this is, this kind of thinking, I believe, is at the one of the roots of all our difficulties around the world, you know, thinking we can manage. Basically, it's like playing God with the rest of the world.
Well, no, there was this American intention. I mean, here you had a guy like Barack Obama. I mean, everyone agrees. Barack Obama is a cool guy, a smart guy, a nice guy. I mean, has there ever been a more likable person in the White House? But these were his policies. So what on earth is going on?
Well, I think the U.S. has been trying, you know, somehow this reminds me, I don't know if you ever read this book called The China Mirage by James Bradley. And it's all about how back in the 30s, the people in Washington, they were sort of being briefed by U.S. missionaries in China who really thought that the Chinese were just longing for Christianity. And the people in Washington bought this, and they thought they could manage China. Well, we see what happened there. You know, you have and these diplomats. You know, they're mostly Ivy League characters. You know, they think very highly of themselves, and they keep screwing up. And this has been happening. You know, what happened in Vietnam? The best and the brightest. You know, it's just somehow the U.S. thinks it can manage. Well, like playing God, the thing is, unlike God, the U.S. is not omnipotent or all-knowing. Well, they may think they are. And it's just, this is the problem. It should be so obvious to anybody, but it still seems to be going on in Washington under Obama and now under President Trump.
Well, I'm going to... I hope your readers don't, you know, your listeners don't turn your channel off. But Trump has taken issue with these policies. Mm-hmm. Trump actually told an audience in Texas in 2014 that he does not believe in the doctrine of American exceptionalism, and Trump seems to be, in his own confused way, trying to wind down or limit or somehow impose reason on America's international commitments. But the guy, the guy's thinking is highly confused. He's a right winger. He's surrounded by crazy people like Michael Flynn, for example. Mm-hmm. So he's being yanked in all directions. So no one knows what's going to emerge out of this process. But Trump is a bit different than Obama was.
Well, I think that's why the Washington establishment was so much against him and why so much of the media is against him, that now and then he blurts out the truth, as unlikely as that seems.
Right. I think it's true. I think you're absolutely right.
Well, it's then just the other day, now the news is that Trump has made some veiled threat of sending the U.S. Army into Mexico, and he's also succeeded in really ticking off one of our big allies, the Prime Minister of Australia.
Well, yes, but the real action is in Iran and Ukraine. I mean, in the Ukraine, for example, fighting has flared. It seems to be pretty clear it was the Ukrainians who started it. Mm-hmm. But now serious fighting is underway. And in Iran, we have Mike Flynn, who, as I said before, is crazy, threatening some kind of military retaliation for a Iranian missile test, and also the fact that the Houthis fired off a guided missile at a Saudi warship and apparently inflicted serious damage. So Flynn is threatening some kind of military retaliation, and the question is whether Trump will go along with it. If he goes along with it, he'll do serious damage to his relations with Russia. Any hope of a rapprochement will be kind of blown out of the water. Mm-hmm. So he may not want to go along with it. I really don't know. I can't pretend to read Trump's mind, but that's what the big question is now.
Do you think Iran is doing something illegal when they did a missile test? Don't other nations test their missiles now and then?
Of course not. Of course. It's totally within its rights. And there's no evidence whatsoever that it's in any way responsible for the Houthi attack on that Saudi warship. There's just, you know, this right wing concept the Houthis are simply pawns of the Iranians just flies in the face of the facts. Mm-hmm. So Iran is within its rights when it comes to the missile test, and it's clearly not responsible for the Houthi attack on the Saudi warship. So Flynn's words, threats are crazy, but you know, craziness sometimes prevails. So will Trump go along with it or not? I mean, if he goes along with it, his foreign policy is, you know, in ruins.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then this flare-up of fighting in Ukraine, you know, might remind our listeners that a lot of this began under Obama when Victoria Nuland was out there in Kiev passing out cookies to these rioters. And, you know, this is the U.S. strategy then, another color revolution, you know, and I guess one theory is that the Ukrainians feel that this is their last chance to goad Russia into striking back or something, because you know, Trump will take away that opportunity. But the way it looks now, Trump is such an unstable guy, so confused, surrounded by madmen, and there's no telling where this might all lead to. It's really it's alarming,
it's
really, to say the least.
It's totally alarming and it's totally perplexing, we'll have to see. We'll have to watch and see over the next few days as to how this plays out. But clearly the Ukrainian government is trying to put pressure on Trump, and their allies in Washington, which include Democrats no less than Republicans, are urging them on. And Trump's inner circle is also trying to put pressure on him as well. So the question is how he responds.
Oh, boy. We've been talking with Daniel Lazar, writer for Consortium News, The Nation. Do you have a website or you have any articles coming up soon that we should look for?
I have another piece coming up on Putin and Trump and the question of Iran. I mean, Trump's so we'll see what happens.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us. We've been talking with Daniel Lazar, writer for Consortium News and The Nation magazine. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
It's KBOO Portland on your Thursday morning. We're about 15 minutes away from Flashpoints. Dennis Bernstein hosts your daily news magazine. At 11 o'clock today, Between the Covers, we'll be talking to Max Nemtsov about his Russian translation of the classic Gravity's Rainbow. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk presents Portland native Renee Watson and her new work, Piecing Me Together. That is all coming up this morning, but first, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Hey, thanks KBOO members for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There's a time commitment about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station and pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is February 18th at 5 p.m. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to the community, and KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. Apply today to support your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.